Good evening. I'm Catherine Loper, News Director for WRVO Public Media. We are pleased to bring you the latest in our series of community forums on health topics, sponsored by the Health Foundation for Western and Central New York. Tonight, we are at the CNY Philanthropy Center in Syracuse, home of the Central New York Community Foundation. Our topic is the rise of the use of heroin in upstate New York and the many effects it's having on the health, safety, and societal fabric of this region. Heroin use is increasing all across the country, and central and northern New York are no different. The impact of this illegal drug hit home in this area this spring when two SUNY Oswego students died from heroin overdoses. But there are many other examples of how this addiction is taking hold and wreaking havoc. In central New York, calls to the Upstate Poison Center about heroin increased by more than 400% in the four-year period from 2009 to 2013. Onondaga County has the highest percentage of babies born addicted to heroin in New York State. Approximately 26 of every 1,000 newborns have some form of drug dependency, and half of those are addicted to opiates like heroin. While those numbers are startling, the personal stories behind them are often just simply tragic. But how did we get here? Why are so many people using heroin? We'll explore the connection between the abuse of pain medications and heroin use and the medical traits of opioid addiction and recovery. And we'll discuss what can be done to combat this epidemic. I'm pleased to introduce our three regional experts who will educate us about this topic and help us sort through all these issues. Dr. Laura Martin is a family practitioner and is board certified in addiction medicine. She's associated with the St. Joseph's Physicians. She's an osteopath and one of the few doctors licensed in Onondaga County to prescribe Suboxone, a drug used to reduce cravings in people recovering from prescription painkillers and heroin addiction. Brad Finn is the executive director of the Prevention Network. Brad is a credentialed prevention professional and serves on a number of advisory groups that work on addiction. Before coming to the Prevention Network here in 1999, Brad also worked on addiction issues in Cortland and Binghamton, New York. And finally, I'm very pleased to have joining us this evening a heroin survivor. Ashley grew up in central New York and was introduced to opiate pain medication while studying at Syracuse University. Shortly thereafter, she started using heroin, and by age 24, she was homeless, but she fought her addiction, got her life together, returned to school, and is now a certified substance abuse counselor. Ashley has asked that we not use her last name as she shares her experience with us both as an addict and as someone who is now helping addicts. So thank you all for joining me. I really appreciate you taking the time to be on this panel. I want to just start with, and maybe Brad, you can start and help us to understand how heroin has come to the point today where some people are considering it an epidemic. You know, it's been around for a long time, but it's just suddenly become this huge issue for our community. If you could describe how you think that came to be.
Certainly, heroin's always been present in all communities. I think what has transpired today is there are more users than ever before. Previously, we had certain subsets of the community that were heroin addicts. We knew that they were heroin addicts. And a lot of people who get into addictions, not certainly by choice, but end up with an addiction, they have a number of what they call drugs of choice. And heroin is was a very popular drug. We had, you know, among some of the artists, the community where they could have access and availability, kind of a network. But what's happened now is, because we've had this explosion for a number of reasons that we could get into here, certainly, that now we have a lot more people using it than ever before.
And Laura, I think part of it is because of a surge in addiction to painkillers has led to more heroin use, is that correct?
A huge surge in addiction to painkillers. And actually, that's where a lot of this starts. It goes back 10, 15 years when we were possibly under-treating pain, and for people that needed it, there was a huge movement in the medical community to be more compassionate, to prescribe pain medication more freely, and it became what we call the fifth vital sign. And in everybody's medical record, it was audited and demanded by the insurance companies that we now pay attention to pain, that pain scale, 1 to 10. How are you feeling? Are we really treating your pain well? And there was such a surge in people that were trying to do the right thing that actually the numbers of prescriptions were just humongous. And it's changed the world of prescription pain medicine. Of course, everyone figures if it's a prescription, it's probably much safer than heroin that you get on the streets. And it's probably pretty safe. So if I have a little more pain, I can take a little more medicine. And when suddenly it's cut off or the prescription ends and you get sick, sometimes you then go and look for something else. And it's important to remember that your brain changes with the first dose.
Because heroin and a lot of painkillers like oxycodone, OxyContin are related. They're all in the same
class. They act on the same receptor in your brain. So sometimes when there's no longer access to pills or they're more expensive, heroin is cheaper. And that sometimes is a result.
And Ashley, from your personal experience, that was sort of your journey, starting with painkillers and moving on to heroin, correct?
Absolutely. I sometimes, looking back now, wonder if heroin would have ever been part of my life or my story had I not gotten there through pain medication. And just like Dr. Martin said, you know, your brain changes, and I didn't realize what was really happening to me, but I was taking them recreationally, or so I thought, and then they were gone, and I was feeling uncomfortable and didn't really know that this was the beginnings of withdrawal. And then slowly but surely, I started doing the pills more regularly, and they were gone, and somebody offered me heroin. And it was like, you know, you always have been taught it's like the worst thing you could do. And it's like a moment of, like, snapshot in my life where I remember saying, well, sure, yeah, I'll take a bag of heroin. And, like, I like saw myself from outside myself, like, in disbelief, but did it anyways because of this uncomfortable feeling I had as a result of the pills. And from there, the floodgates opened and full addiction ensued.
Well, I think, too, we have to clarify, this isn't just discomfort. It's physical pain and tremendous difficulty in going through withdrawal from a painkiller. I have a lady that just had pain medications after a knee surgery that took probably 2 months to recover after her medications were taken away. It was a tremendously difficult time. So when you're asking someone to not have anything, it's very difficult off on your own, not under a doctor's care, trying to fight your way through and someone's offering you a solution. This is what we face. And just to clarify how much we're writing, I mean, the United States has about 4.6% of the world's population. We consume 95% of the world's oxycodone. I don't think we have 95% more pain.
Of course, for the people who really need it, you know, this is not to disparage the people who truly need it, but it's gotten to a lot of people who don't truly need it, and that's why there's been laws like the I-STOP law, which I think has cut off the supply for some people and probably caused more people to turn to heroin. Is that true, Brad?
Yeah, we know statistically anywhere between 77 and 80% of people who are using heroin today did start by route of legitimate, I call them the working wounded. I mean, they did start on a legitimate prescription that got out of control. Absolutely. And that can easily be done with opiates. You're lulled into it. Along with this perfect storm, what came about, too, was heroin, when it came back recently, is much more pure, and it's much less expensive than ever before. So now you have that shift. You can go to something that will give you more of a boost if you could even get that high anymore. And I think what Dr. Martin was talking about, too, was a lot of people, when they've reached that point in their addiction, what they want to do is avoid the depression. They want to avoid the withdrawal. So it even gets to the point where using and increasing your dosage because your tolerance is just to stave off that withdrawal and the discomfort, the pain, the misery of withdrawal. So I think that's an important piece to consider.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a community health forum on WRVO Public Media. I'm Catherine Loper, WRVO News Director. Today we are discussing the heroin addiction and epidemic. Laura, maybe you can explain, you started to go down this road a little bit, of what physically goes through your body as an addict. Like, how does this physically work? How do you become addicted to heroin?
Well, we wish we could figure out who's predisposed to this and who isn't, but there is some predisposition in people. There are people that take their first dose of Percocet, maybe with a surgery, that get ill, that feel awful, that never want it again. And there are others that say, wow, I feel good. I have energy. I can clean my house. This is good. I want more of this, and take it more regularly. So there are people that use it and get pain relief and just become dependent. Medically, there are people that really crave this drug from the first, and it actually changes the physiology inside your brain. It can happen as early as the first dose that you take. So it's difficult to sort out who these people are going to be, so being very careful as we prescribe this has to be a piece of this. So we're doing a lot of work trying to educate physicians on proper opiate prescribing, and in fact there's legislation to try to make sure that they take extra courses every year. If you're going to be prescribing high doses of medications that are opiates, that you have to take a class on it and maybe become more familiar with where it ends up.
So if it can start changing your brain as early as the first time you use it, I mean, that addiction can begin with
the addiction begins, the craving begins, it's got hold of you, so that when it's sitting there, you really have this physical predisposition to pick that up and take another one.
Right, and you mentioned...
And we can see that on scans.
Right. Oh, you can?
Yes, there are certain kinds of scans that you can see where parts of the brain light up that have become activated that are looking for this.
That's interesting. And you mentioned you can't tell who's going to become addicted and who's predisposed. And we're seeing probably, Brad, you know, different populations who are becoming addicted than, say, 30 or 40 years ago, the last time heroin was really, you know, in the news to a big effect. Who is it affecting? What are the demographics?
Look around. Honestly, I think we've become a society that will not accept pain and discomfort and those negativity parts of living. And so we're always looking for something to help us through those things, through those events, those life crises. And again, we're talking about looking for legitimate relief from pain. We're seeing younger. It crosses all socioeconomics. There isn't one community that isn't impacted. There's no safe place to raise your children. We're talking suburbs. We're talking rural. We're talking people who have high means or no means. It's across the spectrum.
And, I mean, that is the answer. There is no typical user. I mean, Ashley, I'm sure both as a user and as someone who's helping users now, you've seen that too. I mean, you went to Syracuse University. Yeah. A lot of people might not peg you as a typical person who would have this problem.
Addiction doesn't care who you are or how much you have. It will take it, guaranteed. So,
actually, I've been exposed to some statistics that suggest that nationally, 70% white, more suburban than urban, okay? These are people everywhere, every community, as Brad says. I think we can't say I'm in an affluent part of town. More money, more expensive drugs. It's just so. And the other thing is that's crossing into this is a very economic thing, too. I mean, in times when people are hurting for money, they may have an illness and have a ready supply of medication that's being given to them by their doctor, and we're talking grandmas. They turn around and they sell these medications because on the average, it's about $5.
A dollar a milligram.
Yeah, a dollar a milligram. So if you're going out and looking for pills and someone's prescribed 20 milligrams four times a day, add that up for a month. And this is quite a lot of money. They might save a few in case they have a pain, but people with cancer sell their pills. People with real medical illness take just what they need and sell the rest. The other thing is, how many people do you know that have something stuck in their medicine cabinet? They take it because their insurance will pay for it, so why leave half behind or take one or two pills in case you need it? Well, I'll take the whole thing because that's mine, and why throw it away? Because it's paid for, and it sits there. And anybody that can access your bathroom, whether they're visiting your children's friends, someone who's just knocks on your door that you says, oh, can I use the facilities for a little bit? If your house is for sale, someone can look at your house and take some pills. It's really very common that they go missing.
Ashley, I wanted to take a little time to have you tell us your story. I briefly touched upon it in the introduction, but I really wanted it to come from you. If you could just describe for our audience, you know, a little bit more about how that addiction occurred for you.
Well, my addiction started before heroin and before opiates. Started with pretty much everything else except that and led to that in my early 20s. Again, via pills, I was introduced to heroin. I would say that I was doing heroin for a couple months before I decided by just looking around, because, you know, you keep light company, so I was hanging out with other people who were using heroin, and some of them were using IV at this point, and at this point I hadn't. And it was one of those things I said I would never do, but eventually everything I said I would never do, I ended up doing. And about 3 months into using heroin, I started using IV.
And how were you using it before IV? Because I don't think people...
Nasally ingesting it.
Because there's many different ways you can ingest heroin, right?
I mean, those are the two main ways that I know. If you can smoke heroin, I never did that. But once I turned IV, I was not going back to the other way because it's so much more powerful and I became so much more addicted so much quicker. And the withdrawal is way more intense when you start doing that. And really, I mean, the reasoning, I don't know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. Why was I doing this to myself? Why was I self-destructing at such a level? I was reflecting on the way here tonight. You know, I was emotionally out of control. Like dealing with a negative feeling, Brad touched on it a minute ago. This is a culture that does not like to feel negatively. It's a culture that likes to feel good all the time. And God forbid we feel something that's uncomfortable. Like we want to get rid of it as soon as possible. You know, even when you see little kids running around, you know, and they're upset, like you see everybody rallying around to try to cheer them up as fast as possible. Like, I think it's just the nature of the beast. And I was experiencing some trauma in my life. And it was easier to reach outside of myself to deal with how I was feeling than actually feel what I was feeling. So that's kind of where I was mentally and emotionally that led me to addiction, to not deal with my feelings, essentially. And Laura Martin had already been my doctor, and I tried the Suboxone a couple times, but I couldn't stay away from heroin long enough to have the Suboxone work as it's supposed to, because my withdrawals were so bad. I ended up leaving Syracuse and going down to New York City to get on a methadone program, and that was my saving grace, because I couldn't do it on my own, and at that point in time, that's what I needed to get to where I am today. And I was on methadone down in New York City for 9 months, and I was homeless while I was down there. I hit another bottom down there, and I got to a point where I was ready to come back and go through the withdrawal that I knew was coming to me, because every addict's biggest fear is withdrawal. That's what we're perpetually avoiding when you're actively using. It was terrible when I finally made the decision to do it. When I say I did not sleep for 3 months, I did not sleep for 3 months. My whole body hurt. I needed help getting to the restroom. I mean, that's how much physical pain I was in. But at that point, I was ready. Thank God. You know, you hear a lot of buzz about methadone, usually negative, but I'm one of the few people that will say, you know, it does work for some people. That's kind of how my story worked. And then I had all these negative experiences in my 20s, and I didn't know what I was going to do with it. And here I am, I'm semi-educated, and what am I going to do with my life? I kind of threw it away. And so I was looking into how I could turn such a negative experience into something positive that I could stand living with for the rest of my life. And it just made sense to me. Well, addiction counseling, something I'm interested in. It's something I have experience, you know, going through and coming out, fortunately, and haven't looked back since. And it's been pretty rewarding. So, and it is. It's like a different lifetime now, looking back at that time period.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing your story. I think it's a very powerful one, and I'm sure it's one, Laura, you've heard similar versions of, but this is about as successful as it gets, probably. You're listening to a community health forum on WRVO Public Media. We are discussing heroin addiction and the effects it has on society. I'm joined by our panel of experts, addiction specialist Dr. Laura Martin, Brad Finn, executive director of the Prevention Network, and Ashley, a former heroin addict who is now a substance abuse counselor. And one group of people that I mentioned in the introduction but we didn't talk about just now, a concerning problem of heroin addicts is pregnant women and their newborn babies. And I mentioned that statistic at the beginning, and Brad pointed out to me, which I think is important to know, that Onondaga County probably has the highest rate of addicted newborns because we draw from so many other counties around to the NICUs here in Onondaga County. So you're probably getting mothers and babies from many other counties. Is that correct, Brad?
Yes, absolutely. We're the feeder system for Central New York. We have the facilities here to address the multiple issues that these young babies have when they're born. We always say they're drug dependent when they're born. They're really not addicted. They're drug dependent, and you know, by way of mom. We know that of the statistics we have, about 50% of the babies that are identified in the NICU as being drug dependent are directly dependent on an opiate. The other 50% are other drugs. We know that All of the moms tested positive for marijuana. All of the moms tested positive for nicotine. You see, I think when you use one drug, you're more likely to use a number of drugs. There's not too many purists today. So it's a continuum, and people move along that continuum depending on their drug. We know once they get into the opiate, so they move very, very quickly.
And Laura, what do you do to treat these babies who are born dependent?
There are a number of ways they treat them. The first thing is to identify the baby, because you don't always know that the mom has been using. It may not be apparent upon her entrance to the hospital. But once you identify, they have a scale of evaluating the babies that they see at risk. If they're very irritable, if they're crying, I don't have the scale in front of me, but there are various things that they score the baby on, and the baby reaches a certain score. If it reaches a score that's significant enough, they deserve medical treatment, and that medical treatment can come in various forms. There's usually a protocol at the hospital that can be initiated by the nurses right away, making sure that the baby is not in pain and suffering. That course of therapy then can continue for months, depending on the baby. So it does fill up the NICUs. There are certain areas where they had been sending babies home, and Syracuse is one of them, that sometimes they can send the babies home with nurses visiting and take care of that. Other areas have had very poor luck with that, with people disagreeing that the baby should be on medications and taking it away from the baby as soon as they got out of the hospital and having very bad withdrawals, suffering of the baby, and that kind of thing. So there are areas such as Florida where they've taken away that right to treat at home. We are still doing that here and monitoring closely so that our hospitals are a little bit less filled, because that adds up very quickly. Whenever I see these statistics, I like to frame it in the national statistics so that you can kind of get an idea, because this is one of the only ways we can measure how many people out there might be impacted by opiates is to look at something that's very measurable, because moms generally come to the hospital to have their babies. But nationally, it's 8 in 1,000 live births. And New York State, all including New York City and everything, it's 1 in 9, and Onondaga County or is 9 in 1,000. And in Onondaga County, it's 26. So just as an idea, that's what that number means.
I also think that, you know, I'd like to think that we're a little more astute identifying the problem, and so that maybe our numbers are higher.
Sure.
In New York State, there's no uniform reporting on a birth certificate for an addiction. Mm-hmm. It's a miscellaneous line item. So if they're not picking up, or even if a facility is picking up on a baby being drug dependent, if they don't record that in that miscellaneous slot, the statistic doesn't get to Albany. So I think we've been, as a community, as a medical community, has been very astute in identifying the drug dependency. And I think that's another reason our numbers are high. We've talked about this being in everybody's community. So I wouldn't be surprised if, as we move forward, Department of Health saying you've got to identify or look for this on a birth certificate, or trying to get that taken care of at an Albany level, then we might see other numbers climb, unfortunately.
And talking about identifying who's got a problem, Ashley, maybe you can speak to what are some of the warning signs people should look for if you do suspect a loved one or a friend might have a problem? What are some of the telltale signs that you should be looking for?
Of heroin specifically?
Or, you know, painkiller. Yeah, painkillers and heroin.
Well, one thing I know to be true is that heroin is not a social drug. People generally tend to use it in isolation. It's not something you're going to go out and use with a bunch of people, like in a bar setting, for example. So the tendency to isolate becomes much more great. There's a few key characteristics that are visible. One is called the pinning of the pupils. They become very, very small when they're under the acute influence of heroin or opiates. And then during withdrawal, the opposite happens. Your pupils dilate to a point that it just looks not right. Flu-like symptoms that are unexplainable, that kind of don't go away. If you have the flu, if you have for a couple weeks, that's one thing. But if you're starting to feel like you have the flu all the time and exhibiting that, like, you know, you're freezing and you're cold and it lasts for a long time, that could be an indication. Weight loss, things start disappearing out of your house that are valuable.
Mm-hmm. Brad and Laura, anything else to add to the warning signs?
The only thing that I would add is that many people, by the time the person is confronted or we have a discussion with family members, they already know. They know there's something wrong, they just can't put their finger on it. And they may not have said heroin, but they know that something is wrong. They don't talk about it. It's something that everybody stands back and wouldn't want to say anything if they're not right, etc. So when we have that discussion, one of the first things that I have people do is invite the family in and talk to their family. If they haven't told their mom or their dad or their spouse, they need to. They need to stop lying and they need to come clean with everybody. And overwhelmingly, they already know. So when you already know, and when you know that people are cyclically ill, can't get off the couch for days, and then they're running around and cleaning the house for days. I mean, these kinds of things. If you're noticing something's wrong, talk about it and bring it to their attention and tell them that you notice.
I'd say always trust that gut feeling. You know something's wrong, you can't put your finger on it. You know, one of the things that when we're looking at this 75 to 80%, access and availability is a big piece. Know what you have in your medicine cabinet. Absolutely. If you do have something, inventory it. Make sure that when, if you've got children and their friends come over, they don't have access to it. Because even if your child isn't, your child might be contributing to someone else's addiction by having the access of, and availability of opiates in the medicine cabinet. I liked what also actually said, you know, things will start disappearing in your house. And what I'm talking about is people have to support their habit. And as your habit grows, their expenses grow proportionally. So now we're losing things from the house. We have people pawning. We have people stealing. And it becomes a very real situation. I want to stress, too, that, you know, I don't know of one addict out there that doesn't have people who love him and her. And I mean, this is something I think we forget to talk about sometimes, that how impacted the family is, the moms are, the dads are, the brothers, sisters, cousins, when we have an addiction in a family. We often focus on the addicted person, which is great. They're the ones who need treatment. But the whole family needs treatment. The whole family needs help. And we don't have those resources today like we do. We have limited resources for the heroin addict. But we really don't have resources for the family, and they need to get help as well as the addicted one. I think sometimes we forget about that.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, you're listening to a community health forum on WRVO Public Media. I'm Catherine Loper, news director at WRVO, and today we're discussing heroin addiction and the effects on society. And Brad, I think you bring up a good point. You know, family members need help too, but you know, what are some of the resources in this community, if a family member suspects a loved one might have a problem, what would you recommend? Where should that family member go? What should they do first? And obviously be open and try to talk to their loved one. But if they need help, they need some guidance, where can they go?
Well, hopefully they have some resources to go into some professional counseling. We certainly recommend that. And getting set up, there's many facilities, there's many licensed treatment providers who can work with families. Some very good ones in our community. We're fortunate for that. And most communities will have tracks for family members. Even if the addicted one doesn't get healthy and well and seek treatment, if the family gets healthy, the loved ones get healthy around the addict, lots of times that will break enabling behavior. It will break the codependency. It will break the cycle that, quite truthfully, keeps that addiction going for the individual. And I've seen a lot of families get healthy, and when the families got healthy, the addicts kind of had a wake-up call. They're not playing the addicted game anymore, and now the addict's on their own, and a lot of tough love goes along with that.
Mm-hmm. Ashley, did you want to add to that?
Oh, I agree with the tough love and kind of like a family system. You know, the addict isn't the only one that's sick. The whole family system becomes sick, and it's kind of like a mobile. If you take one piece of the mobile and grab it, and shift it, all the other ones kind of have to rebalance themselves. So everything changes. And I think that enabling behavior and that denial that a lot of parents have, oh, it can't be my kid, no, 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 that just perpetuates the addiction. And the longer it goes, the more unsafe it is for the person and the more harm that's essentially done. So I think, you know, breaking through that veil of denial, identifying the problem is the first step in all this for families, and to talk about it. I can't stress communication enough, because this is something that is brushed under the carpet that nobody wants to talk about. Nobody wants to believe that somebody in their family is addicted to heroin. you know, I couldn't even believe what's happening to myself. It's just something that you don't want to talk about. It's been taboo for so long. But I think by talking about it, we lessen that stigma that goes along with it and the shame that goes along with it. Because there's addiction, it comes with regret and guilt and shame. And those are all very negative feelings that cause people to want to isolate and hide the truth. So I think the more we talk about it, the more comfortable society as a whole is going to be if the problem ever presents itself, to be able to communicate what is actually going on.
I often hear, especially during the Senate task force that went around the state, and people were able to stand up and speak to our elected officials, and I always heard a lot of folks talking about there's no treatment for me, and that's true. There are limited forms of treatment. There are people waiting for treatment slots to open up. But I'm a firm believer also, if you want help, there's 12-step group help. That's in every community. You have, you know, Narcotics Anonymous. You have a number of 12-step meetings in this community alone where people could go if they truly want some help. Now, we did talk about the nastiness of the withdrawal, and that needs to be addressed. So it's hard to just say, oh, go cold turkey and go to a 12-step group. But there's also 12-step groups for family members. We don't have any local Naranons, but you know what? A drug is a drug is a drug, and what that family is going through, whether that drug is alcohol, whether that drug is cocaine, whether that drug is heroin, Al-Anon works wonders for family members, and you are, everyone is welcome. No one has ever turned away from a 12-step group. Matter of fact, my experience with Al-Anon is they said they will refund my misery if after six meetings I don't get some help.
That's good. Speaking of the medical help that's out there, we've mentioned a couple of the medications that can be used, and maybe, Laura, you could explain how you do treat addicts and how they work and do they work?
Well, there are a number of treatment types, and I would have to say that there is no perfect treatment. I think that the focus of every treatment has to be the counseling. That's what does the good and helps you to change the way that you think. Everything else is just to help to keep you alive until that breaks through. So certain medicines work for some people and others work for others, but there are a number of choices. Methadone is one of them, and it's been very successful, and there's a number of articles that have been written in medical journals that can show you the success. With no treatment at all, your success rate in a month is 5% of staying clean. And of that, there's a death rate associated with that number. So of the people that go back to using, a percentage of them die. So that's a very risky thing. With treatment, now you can extend that and allow them counseling, help them to stabilize their life, help them to regain the trust of their family, begin to add support around themselves, pull their support together, their team, get their counseling, and they can start counseling way before starting any medication, and that's what I encourage them to do until they can get in somewhere. Bring the families in. There is a medicine called Suboxone that's a medicine that we give in the office that allows office-based opiate treatment where you don't have to go to a clinic and walk under the sign that says the drug treatment place or whatever it says in some, or the not marked little brick building that everyone knows who goes in there. So you can go to your doctor's office and be treated for a medical problem and sit next to the people with diabetes and coughs and colds and hypertension. And so that is very comfortable for many people, especially if you have a job, don't want to be identified and singled out and need to have that ability to move around in the community and keep that job. So that is a good option for some people. It's not for everybody, and it's certainly not a perfect medicine. There's a medicine called Vivitrol that's given by injection. It's a blocker of opiates so that when you get an injection for a month, that opiate receptor is blocked in your brain and you're unable to get high. It blocks the opiate from getting into your system, and it allows you that time to look into all of the other recovery services that are available. There are pills of the same medication that you can just take it day by day and block the opiates each day. We worry about pills and medications that you can choose not to take unless you have a helper reminding you to take it, because you could wake up one day and say, not today, I think I'll use today. So there are a number of things that need to be put in place in any program, surveillance kinds of things where we make sure that they're going to counseling, drug testing to make sure they're taking what we're giving them, not taking anything else. We encourage them to quit smoking at the same time because as Brad said, these other substances do things to your brain that fail to let your brain recover and get back on track, and people are actually a little bit more successful when they do quit smoking at the same time. So there are a lot of things lumped in there, and at the same time, we are able to get people into a better health, because oftentimes they've spent maybe a short number of years, maybe a long number of years neglecting their health, not getting their pap tests, not getting their blood work done. Maybe they have high blood pressure, cholesterol, heart disease. I treat people up into their 70s for addiction. This is not solely a disease of young people. And the other thing that I think my big perception that I have to change in the family's eyes is that this is a long-term treatment. I have an awful lot of people that think they'll come for a couple of months and go home, and you'll be able to go back to college, and everything will be fine, and this medicine will stop, and we'll put this behind us and forget about it. And one of the first times that I meet with people, I try to rearrange that perception, and I think that's very significant.
You're listening to a community health forum on WRVO Public Media. I'm joined by a panel of experts, addiction specialist Dr. Laura Martin, Brad Finn, executive director of the Prevention Network, and Ashley, a former heroin addict who is now a substance abuse counselor. And we've been talking a lot about the medical effects on the addict and the mental health effects. But Brad, I wanted you to maybe address this affects a lot of aspects of society. We've talked a little bit about crime, how the family's affected, but if you could just address, you know, what this is doing to, you know, our community.
Of course, this is only my perspective.
Absolutely.
And what, prior to this epidemic and the surgence of heroin, we all were familiar with what happened with bath salts. Bath salts, synthetic marijuana came about, and we were caught off guard as communities. We had a lot of media, we were scared, and what that did for communities was it mobilized people, it brought people together, task force were formed, focus groups, specific targeted organizations all came together to deal with the bath salts. As professionals working in this field, we also understood that we knew opiates were there, but let's take care of the bath salts. So when the opiate epidemic hit, we had a lot of resources in place. It may sound like we were caught off guard, and to some degree we were, just like with bath salts, just like we were back when crack cocaine hit, just like, you know, we were when methamphetamine hit. It's kind of like a whack-a-mole game we play. We knock one down, another one pops up. So following the bath salt scare and the mobilization, we had a lot of communities come together. Within the communities, communities have solutions. We've seen a lot more coalitions being built. And what I like about community solutions is that that solution is in place for the next epidemic, whatever that is. And believe me, we get over this one, there will be another one of some sort. Right now, there's chemists trying to figure out what they can do to circumvent the law, or they're coming back with an old drug that's pure or less expensive. So community mobilization, I think, is real important. Getting people educated in communities is very important. You know, I always look at the positive side of this, that, you know, we are having discussions. And Ashley said, you know, more families are having discussions on this than ever before. And so that opens up all types of communications, not just about opiates. I'm very optimistic of, you know, okay, we've got this terrible scourge going through all of our communities, but we are trying to address it, and by coming together and working as a community, not just one treatment will work, not just one prevention modality will work. The fabric of our community has got to be woven in such a way that we have a lot of these assets in place. We try to reduce risk factors and increase protective factors is what we try to do. And whether that's heart disease, whether that's an addiction, whether that's, you know, drug-dependent babies, we try to address it by saying, okay, here's where we are today. What can we put in place, whether it's through policies, through prevention, education, or enforcement compliance to address today's problem, but also what's going to be next on the horizon?
Ashley, when you were dealing with this, did you find the resources out there that you needed? I mean, you did find your way to a doctor and to a methadone treatment program, but, I mean, did that take some time to figure out where to go and what to do when you were ready to try something?
I'm somebody that has gone through a lot of different treatment modalities. I went to several inpatients, several detoxes. I tried the Suboxone program, and then the methadone program is what I went to in the end. And the one that I found that had a waiting list was the methadone program, which in Syracuse, if I'm not mistaken, it's still just Kraus that offers that. And there is quite a waiting list. And for somebody who's an opiate user, you tend to be rather transient. And when your name comes up on the list, you know, you have 2 weeks to respond. And then if you don't, you have to go back at the bottom of the list. I know today that people are having a hard time getting into treatment. They're being turned away, told that they're not sick enough when they're very sick. So I see that as an issue, because I'm a firm believer that if somebody is seeking treatment, whether they're capable of doing it or not at that moment, they're seeking it out, and they should be given the opportunity to at least try. But I see that, and I hear that a lot from my clients, that, you know, well, the intake people at admissions said I wasn't sick enough because I didn't test positive for opiates or whatever it was that they were going for. But they have a long history of using, you know, maybe it'd been a couple of days. Not everybody finds ways to use every day, because it's a lot of things you have to go through to get your fix, so to speak. You know, it takes up your whole entire day, and it saddens me that people are turned away when they're contemplating the idea of getting better. So that's something that could do to change.
Right. And Laura, are there things or one thing you think you'd like to see change to help families and addicts better deal with this problem?
Big hope that I have is for more prevention. I think that's the area that we're not talking to kids young enough. We're talking to high school people. The average age of first use is like 13. Okay, we need to get into the grade schools and certainly middle schools easily to talk to them. We need to talk to families who are not afraid to talk to their children at those young ages, and maybe give some age-appropriate resources, books, things like that that they can share. And there are some out there that are written on a level that you can talk to your 10 and 11-year-old, and those are the ages that we need to find and prevent. We have to be really, really sure that we're not letting people think this isn't in their community. We have to talk to church groups and community groups, and this is what's happening that's exciting, because we're really letting people know that it is in your community. And it's very, very sad when it hits and can be followed by death often. And we've talked about a couple of deaths, but it's astronomical, the number that occur in Onondaga County. It's huge. You hear about them regularly. I'd like to see that prevention arm really improved. I feel a little bit different with the treatment end of things. I think that we need to be getting into the counseling. I have not heard of a lack of counseling services, and that's the first thing. Everyone wants the medication, but that has to be the start. And if somebody comes into my office, until they've gone that route and at least touched base with someone, I don't treat them and give them a medicine. I don't think they're motivated enough, because someone can decide. I'll talk to them. I'll tell them how they can begin and have a discussion. One of the things we're trying to put in place is this ESPERT system, where anyone that comes into an emergency room is screened. 3% of all people are referred for addiction through a primary care office. So we're not finding them. They don't tell us. They don't come in and say, I'm having a problem, don't give me that pill. You know, they don't say that. They might eventually, in their own conscience, say, I need to seek out help, or they might get in trouble with the law. They don't come to their doctor often and have that. And certainly if they don't say it, we don't find it. So this ESPERT, this screening, which Brad can talk a little bit about, we're trying to get into the hospitals, into the emergency rooms, into the urgent cares, so that this service, this screening, brief intervention, referral to treatment can happen, so that everybody can at least focus on these questions and see if they have a problem.
Yeah, that's ESPERT is, from my own experience, I fill out 2 or 3 pages of check marks when I go into any physician's office, and because they're screening for hypertension, they're screening for diabetes, they're screening for a number of depression, a number of problems I might have. So what ESPERT is about is a very simple tool that would put up some red flags for the medical professional, whoever's doing that screening. And if it was universal, if not just your emergency departments or your you know, primary, if your primary care is doing it, if you're getting the same screening at the OBGYN level, if everybody's doing the screening, what's been proven effective is we can identify early stage addiction. With any illness, and we're talking about a disease here, when we identify it early stage, the prognosis is always better. We have a much better chance to do an intervention. So we are working right now trying to make it a protocol across Central New York for any OBGYN or family clinic to perform this simple ESPRT screening. The beauty of ESPRT is you can bill for it. So there's an economic incentive as well for offices to do it. Actually, we are working trying to get it as a recommendation for all OBGYNs. And it's an early intervention. And it's done in that medical setting, so it has that weight. It isn't about shame or guilt. It isn't, you know, there are we take away a lot of that other piece. It's just like being screened for anything else we have. So we're very optimistic in the community here that we're infusing this type of protocol and practices as many places as we can, because we want to stop that flow of addicts to come in looking for treatment. We want to catch them earlier on.
Because I think it's important to emphasize one thing you noted, that often it's first responders who first come into contact with addicts, whether that's police or paramedics or, you know, the hospital emergency room, and that's often the first sort of official person who has some sort of contact, and getting it through a doctor's office sounds like it'd be a better pathway to treatment.
Certainly conducive to having a discussion and offering them, you know, the choices of treatment that are available, yes.
Well, I think we could talk about this for another hour, but our time is running out. So in conclusion, I wanted to ask each of our panelists what the one message you would give the public about the addiction or what we could be doing to help combat it. Laura, maybe we'll start with you.
I have two things. One is to never believe it can't touch your family. If it hasn't yet, it will in some way, whether it's more distant or closer to you. It's just so widespread that you need to take an active part in remembering how to prevent it in your own life, and that you can make a difference by locking your medications, by not taking extras home, by doing small things, by taking a look at the people that you know and bringing it up if you think that they may have a problem, helping them to discuss it. And that leads into number two, is don't let them feel that shame. This is a medical problem. It's a problem that can be treated medically, that you can survive, and or you can die. So I think that this is very much impacted by your neighbors, your friends, the people that talk to you all the time, and I think we all have to take a very personal interest in it and never think that it can't touch your life.
And Brad?
I was just thinking, what's going through my mind, certainly, with such harm and damage is done to people. Love the person, hate the disease. That's something we often say in addictions, because the disease is here, the person you loved is here, and that person will come back. I know from personal experience when people get into recovery. The thing is, don't accept it. Don't accept that this is the norm. I love communities to mobilize. We have the resources across all of the listening area here to build community coalitions. We are funded through the Office of Alcoholism and Substance Abuse Services to build community coalitions. There is funding available when you build community coalitions. And again, it builds a system so that you have that in place, not just for this epidemic, but for the next one too. So the Prevention Resource Center covers 13 counties from St. Lawrence County to Delaware County. It's part of the Prevention Network, and we would love to come into your community and work with you as technical assistants. We're not going to do the work. We'll help guide you to build a coalition to address all elements of this issue.
And Ashley?
Talk about it. If there's something going on, there's an addiction, there's something bad that you're experiencing, that you're going through, talking about it's not going to make it already worse. You're already living it. Talking about it's going to bring you help. So communication. I always stress communication.
Well, I'd like to open up our forum now to questions from the audience. Just a reminder, if you have a question, please step forward to the microphone to your left. Identify yourself and let us know if you want to address your question to a particular panelist or to the panel as a whole. And I'll note, in case our panelists didn't know, we have a number of social worker students here in the audience, so maybe some of you or anyone else has a question. Anyone? Come on up here so we can hear you.
My name is Jackie, and I'm one of the social work students. So my question is for Ashley. How long were you actually addicted, and how long did it take you to recover?
I was addicted from 21, 22 to 25. October 6, 2009, I took my last dose of methadone. So it was about a 3.5-year period. But that was the end of my addiction. I really want to clarify that. Like, before heroin was cocaine, and before cocaine was hallucinogenics, and before hallucinogenics it was marijuana and alcohol, and it all kind of led to heroin. So I was somebody that already had a very addictive personality.
Could I add something to that?
Sure.
Recovery's a lifetime.
Yeah.
It's not a set, by this date you're going to be fine. Recovery is a process, and it's a lifetime. And once people start getting the rewards of recovery, you can't stop them. You can't put them down. It's phenomenal to watch that.
And I think we noted earlier, a lot of the traits of heroin addiction are similar to traits of other addictions. And so, you know, a lot of what we're saying here applies to other addictions as well. It's just, this is what's in the news right now and what this community is particularly facing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Would you mind coming up here to the microphone? Thanks so much for having a question.
My first thought's still very sick.
My name's Alex.
Still.
I'm actually a student with the group, and I'm also a care manager in the local honey system. So my question is actually for the panel itself. You talked about reporting and documentation on this. Do you think they're doing enough at the level with the hospitals and the psych wards? I asked for personal experience because I had a client that had disappeared. I had looked through the Rio and the psyches, and there was nothing listed that he'd actually gone in on an overdose. I only found out when the social worker had called me, but there was nothing electronically documented to warn us or to let us know that that's what you've been in for.
We cannot share that information, so unless you have a signed release there for HIV and addiction, you can't get that. Just
yeah, that's what the Rio is. They have to sign consent form for the Rio and for the psyches. They have to sign a consent specifically for New York State Office of Mental Health.
My limited knowledge of Rio is it's a database that everybody is supposed to enter data into to track medical records. But I don't believe everybody enters that data.
And I think it's limited to Medicaid recipients, too. Rio is mainly comprised of services that have been funded through Medicaid. So I think it was part of the Behavioral Health Organization, but I'm not totally certain on that.
Well, this does bring up what you mentioned earlier. The state enacted some new laws to help prevent heroin. But, I mean, are there things like tracking that you think the state should require more of or could be doing more of on a state level? I mean, Medicaid's a state program, for example.
I think to use that type of a database to find people or find out about people, there are safeguards in place to protect people's information. So there's only certain people who's allowed access.
Mm-hmm. Did that answer your question a little bit?
Yeah, to you guys. I guess I was asking because we do have Medicaid. That's 90% of our people, and they are required to sign the psyches, are required to sign the Rio consents. So I guess that's what I was trying to find. Is there something within that, even with the CBIRT, that could be employed so that within the honey system we have better access to that so we can help coordinate the care much better, working with the Circus Behaviorals, the Conifer Parks, the different treatment agencies, because we do interact with all of them on a routine basis, mm-hmm. and we actually have our own CASAC team within our agency. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm trying to, if there's a way we could do it, is there a better policy or something we could do to help coordinate better care for these individuals?
Right. I think it boils down to intensive case management, where you have a small load of clients that you are able to work with to an intimate level. You interact, you go grocery shopping, you know, and right now, until we put resources into that type of a system, I think it's going to be difficult to track people.
And I mean, it brings up something Ashley brought up before. I mean, addicts can be transient, and you know, they may be in your facility one day and another facility, you know, 2 months from now. And I can understand, you know, what you're talking about, that that might help treatment, but that's awfully hard to do.
Yeah, with ours, we I'll have somebody come in. We network with the person that they're connected with in counseling. If I refer them to somebody and we make that connection right away, then I know where they are, and we talk regularly. In general, you know, I'll have somebody text me, so-and-so was just here, had a good session, blah, blah, blah. I know when they come, I know when they miss. But that's very, very individual, and we have to incorporate into that that every single time they come, I make sure they're still in that program and haven't switched, because now I have to switch my tracking. So it's difficult.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for your question. Yes?
Hi, I'm Jeremy Frenchler. I'm from the Children's Consortium, and we're actually partnered with 410 Crafts, the methadone clinic here, to do some parent education. And I was wondering if anyone on the panel could speak to working with parents who are either drug addicted or in treatment, and any experience you have with that, any recommendations for how to help them specifically with their parenting and those issues that come along with addiction.
Mm-hmm. There are some evidence-based programs out there specifically for working. I'm just thinking strengthening families, parenting wisely, guiding good choices. There's three right there, what's called evidence-based programs, meaning that if you follow the fidelity of the program, you're going to get a positive outcome. So if you were to call Prevention Network and talk to some staff, they could get you in touch with those programs and where to get training for them and where to look to really be effective when you do reach with and work with the parents.
Yeah, I think the one we use is Nurturing Parenting, which is evidence-based, and they have one for drug addiction specifically. We have worked with the Prevention Network a little bit before as well.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, they also have at some of the counseling services, they'll have groups that are, you know, people don't like to go to a group that they can't identify with. An older man wouldn't want to go to a bunch of teenagers or someone from outside the city coming into the inner city feels a little uncomfortable sometimes. So you try to get like people, and they do have groups of young women with babies, you know, groups of, you know, so they do group some of these together within counseling group services as well.
The beauty of what you're experiencing is that when people get into recovery, parents, they all of a sudden wake up and say, oh, my goodness, I haven't been the best parent. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they want something right now to address their family issues. They're going to be heading back into that war zone. They're going to be heading back home. So anything that we can give them to help them help the family and maintain their recovery, I mean, that's key. So that's excellent work.
We talked a lot about family members in terms of like parents and, you know, siblings and spouses, but when we talk about societal effects, certainly the kids who are affected by their parent having an addiction, that's a big societal, you know, issue to help these kids deal with that.
I'd just like to also say, just knowing that we have this large listening region, in just about every county in that listening region, there is a council on alcoholism. And their function is primarily prevention. So wherever people are listening to this broadcast, know that your community probably has a council on alcoholism, whether it's the Jefferson County Council or St. Lawrence Council or, you know, Lewis County Council. They are there, and they are resources for people to engage in this type of programming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Liz Crockett. I'm executive director at REACH, a CNY. We're an agency that works on health in Syracuse and Central New York. I really appreciated everyone's comments and mentioning just recently evidence-based programs. I wanted to put it out there that the state health department has a number of efforts to reduce, well, certainly to address all the things we're talking about, and because addiction to opiates and heroin is not going to stop immediately for people, and people are not necessarily going to be able to be treated immediately. They're going to need counseling first. There's not the capacity immediately to help people immediately get off heroin. But in the meantime, we want to try to support people's health, treat the addiction, and yet love the people. So there are some evidence-based harm reduction programs that the state has in place to help people access clean needles so that they are not putting themselves at risk, or reducing the risk anyway, of exposure to HIV, hepatitis C, And also try to help them, engage them into counseling services. So in the Syracuse community, there is a needle exchange program run by ACR Health. They are serving over 600 people now. It's a really important program. And there's also something called the Expanded Syringe Access Program available at many pharmacies. So I won't go into detail, but if you go to the New York State Health Department website and look at safe syringe disposal or needle exchange or HIV prevention, you will find really good information about these programs. And it's important that communities support these because they are very helpful to our people. Another harm that is coming to communities that there's concern in Syracuse lately is if used needles are disposed of on the ground in neighborhoods. And I know there's been concern on the west side. And our agency, Reach CNY, is working to try to get more knowledge of how people can dispose of syringes safely and more syringe disposal kiosks available in the community. So if there's any agencies interested or any pharmacies, please contact us. And hopefully we'll have more resources and information in our communities soon. It's a community effort that these community coalitions can help support.
Thank you.
Thanks, Liz.
And did any of you want to comment on any of the issues she brought up?
I've been working with ACR Health, and actually Brad has too, downtown for the needle exchange. And I love listening to the presentation that they give when they come out into communities. The numbers are just staggering and proven good that they're able to do in a community. So I really stand behind that. I think that they're doing great work. And they do things that we wouldn't think about necessarily, like telling people just simple things like, if you can't quit now, don't use alone. Ashley had spoken about using alone and being very isolated. If you're not alone, the chances that you're not going to have help if you overdose or, you know, a little bit reduced. So,
yes, please come on up.
Hi, I'm Cindy Squalacci. I'm a student assistance counselor in one of the high schools. One of my questions has to do with that. I have two questions. One is, if someone is on methadone and wants to go inpatient to recover from the methadone, but they're on Medicaid, is there a way to do that?
When it comes to opiates and withdrawing from opiates and going inpatient, it's generally not done very often. There are exceptions to that, but the reason why is because alcohol withdrawal can be fatal, so can benzodiazepine withdrawal. So can mixtures of drugs. But in general, opiate withdrawal just makes you feel awful. And other than dehydration, if you're vomiting and having a lot of diarrhea and things like that, you are able to survive that withdrawal as an outpatient, as we heard about. So it's generally not something we have to put you in the hospital to protect your life. And hospitalizations happen to protect life. Okay. So it's the rare case that will be admitted, especially when beds are limited, for withdrawal alone. But it does happen.
Okay.
And methadone withdrawal is a very, very long one. People will suffer for months.
And Medicaid pretty much would not pay for an inpatient.
Any insurance, you would have trouble with that one.
Okay.
It's not a Medicaid issue. Is it worth an inpatient hospital bed for that length of time? And the payers generally will say no.
Okay. The second question has to do with Asperger's and children on, or young people on the spectrum, and addictions. I'm wondering if there's anyone in the Syracuse community, because I think because of the social discomfort that people with Asperger's have, that there probably is a high percentage of people who turn toward addictions. And possibly typical ways of dealing with addictions wouldn't work with these people, and we're identifying more and more of them as, you know, in our communities. So I'm just wondering, is anyone doing research on that? Or are there therapists who are working on that, or treatment programs?
Specific to Asperger's, I've not heard of any, but there are dual diagnosis centers. Basically, what we found with people that are using drugs is there is often a concomitant illness. So whether it's Asperger's or whether it's depression, anxiety disorder, bipolar, something that's yet to be uncovered, they don't always know why, but it's easier not to feel awkward and to bury this. And that can sometimes be why this starts, or self-medicating. I feel better when I take this, so I think I can function better. I think I can go to work and smile when I do this, and then it just kind of goes a little bit too far. Specifically Asperger's, I think as we go on, it would be nice to have some ways of identifying them. It is something that is difficult to tweeze out when you've got so many things going on. Oftentimes, people will eventually end up in front of a counselor that might be able to help us to identify that, or a psychiatrist that might be able to help us identify that. And I think that that's I haven't even thought about how many people might be suffering with that. But you're right; they would not respond the same way to treatment. So,
groups.
Right, specifically groups. Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Come on up.
Good evening. My name is Troy White. I'm the HIV outreach specialist for Family Planning Services. We operate 3 clinics in the city of Syracuse. Our rapid testing is part of what we do. We're talking about heroin. We're talking about heroin use. We're talking about intravenous drug use. So we also know that consequently, HIV, hepatitis C, is part of the consequences that come with that. So I just want to put that out there, that we do operate those services in the community, and it's low cost, no cost, which means if a person doesn't have any insurance, they can still utilize our facilities. So I'm HIV outreach specialist, but I also have a lot of history as a substance abuse counselor from the New York City area. And so my question is, we talked about treatment. We talked about detox. We talked about counseling. Now what? Since recovery is a lifelong process, and we know for insurance purposes that detox and treatment is not going to last forever, what's next?
Again, I'm going to go right back to, I'm a firm believer in social support, and one of the best places to get that is through 12-step groups. Because you have people who've been there, done that, who can hold the hands of other people, that can guide other people. You know, I think one of the biggest hurdles that I see for people is they've got to want it. There is no way that if I have a loved one who has an addiction that I can get them to take care of themselves unless they want it. So I think it's real important, because what I've experienced is folks that once they've moved through the treatment, they've detoxified, they're out of counseling. I don't know any legitimate counseling service today that wouldn't say you've got to engage in a church group, a community group, a 12-step group. Do not isolate. Addictions is a disease of isolation. And when you can work with other folks that have been there, who've experienced it, who can watch you, see your signs and symptoms of relapse, who can call you on it honestly, you can start getting honest with yourself then. Not only that, you're able to see the rewards of recovery. You see, what people do is they feel the rewards of their addiction and its brain chemistry and its behavior, and then that becomes their lifestyle. And when you back away from that, once all of the wonderful counseling and drug therapies are gone, what then? It's going to fall on the individual. But if they're around loving, supporting people who know the signs and symptoms of the relapse process, their chances of success are phenomenal. And they will see and start experiencing the rewards of recovery. And once you start getting that reward, it becomes a drug in all of itself, the whole recovery process. So there is that element in all of our communities.
And I thank you for that. And because one of the things that I've observed is that a lot of the facilities does not put a great emphasis on the 12-step fellowship program.
Unfortunately.
And
there's some change in the laws that has precipitated that probably within the last 10 years.
Is that because there is a spiritual undertone to 12-step programs?
Because there is a spiritual undertone, yes. Mm-hmm.
My next question is, let's see, I want to put this here. Insurance. It appears that, you know, now we're talking about the demographics that's changed. So, you know, it's not like the consumer's walking in there with Medicaid. All right. So now for a person that's trying to recover whose parents may not have the Medicaid card, insurance is a problem. How do we deal with that? Some parents can't afford to put their children through treatment. Some facilities don't take everybody's insurance. So it's more than just this here. We got an insurance problem as well. I work with somebody who has put her, you know, one of her children through treatment, and, you know, the co-pays and everything is killing her. So how do we deal with that problem? We start talking about dealing with this heroin epidemic and the demographics has changed. How do we deal with the insurance problem?
Well, you're saying the co-pays have become, that means our insurance is covering it.
Yeah.
But the co-pays are expensive, and treatment can be expensive. The way that I talk to people when they come in for treatment is, how much have you been spending on drugs? Mm-hmm. A lot. How much do you want this? You have the means. If you've been spending that much on drugs, I would like you to turn around and spend a fraction of that on your recovery. And I do see that people who are parents of these people who are trying their very best to pay for the very best programs and get them into all of the recovery services that they need become very frustrated because they want inpatient and intensive outpatient is offered by the insurance company, or they want something that they feel is less than what they should have. There's a certain stepwise approach of the insurance companies. There's good outpatient treatment. There's good counseling as an outpatient. There's good supportive services. And there are many, many services that have a sliding scale that will let people, you know, help people afford the counseling and things like that. Then 12-step program is free. So we have to look at what's logical and right. And what I always tell people when they really, really want the inpatient first is, you know, sometimes it's appropriate and sometimes it isn't. If you don't stay there forever, it doesn't fix you. You know, we have to figure out how to live in the community and live in recovery, too. And there's a place to try to put that in. And if you fail that, then you step up to the next level of treatment. But I have not generally had trouble getting services covered. You have to step through the hoops and fill out the forms and appropriately be seeking therapy and not just do medications. You can't just say, someone do something to me to fix me, but I'm not going to help. You have to be doing the helping things and participating. We find a problem when mom wants the recovery more than the kid does. And it just comes to a place where we can't get things covered because he's not doing his part. And they see that, and they're not going to cover expensive treatments when nobody's going to any of the therapies and participating like they should. Not showing up, things like that. So I think that there are, in the non-insured person is the one who is the most difficult to treat. They have an awfully hard time because it's very expensive. But when you have some kind of insurance funding some of it, I think that we can get a lot of things covered.
And there is a provision under the Affordable Care Act that mental health diseases and addiction falls under that, have to be insured in the same way as physical diseases.
Which counseling had never, you know, sometimes that was optional. You had to pay for all of that yourself. This is a change in the law.
Right.
And there's some, with the Senate task force that went around, right now there's some proposals that deal with promoting affordability of substance abuse treatment, mm-hmm. having parity laws. So there is some hope. And if you look at, actually, it's Senate 7662, which is, I believe, right now pending, that they are looking at these issues to make treatment more accessible to people in behavioral health treatment, addiction treatment, at the same par as physiological health.
And that's the state Senate Brad is referring to, so specific laws to New York State. And Ashley, did you want to add anything? I also, to the first question, did you want to speak at all to how that transition worked for you to go from treatment to rebuilding your life? I mean, that's an important part of the process.
I 100% utilized 12-step program. I went every day, three times a day for my first 6 months. And I got more knowledge in those 6 months than I have in 5 years of school. And that's the other thing, you know, going there and listening. Because even today, if I have a problem, my first thought, my first solution is just going to compound the problem. My first thought's always to run away from whatever I'm dealing with. In a room full of people that have addiction, understand that. And they can laugh with you at these crazy thoughts that you have because it's broken thinking. So I think that, and as a counselor, I highly encourage every single person I see to try 12-step meetings, maybe in spite of being afraid of the whole God stigma that comes along with 12-step meetings, because people mistake it for a religious program. It's not. It's a spiritual-based program. Not saying if you are religious, it can't complement that, because it absolutely can. But you learn things in there that you just don't learn, even in treatment. And there's wisdom in recovery. You know, in Syracuse, there is a phenomenal 12-step community, and it's free.
You know, many times 12-step people who don't want to go there say, well, they'll brainwash me. And the fact is their brain needs washing.
And you answered my last question, and I just want to share that there is Nalanon meetings right in this building every Wednesday at 12 o'clock.
Narana?
Yes.
Beautiful.
There you go. We learned something. Yes, could you come on up, please?
Hi, my name is Alexandra. I'm a graduate student at Syracuse. And I was just curious, we talked a lot tonight about treatment and the individual who has become addicted. But I'm curious about what type of scrutiny is taking place when it comes to the prescription of opiates and also the drug companies.
Well, there's a bunch of things are going on that front. First of all, there have been some legislation. The hydrocodone used to be able to be written without quantity limits of any substance and with refills up to 6 months. That's no longer the case. It's been reclassified, so we can give you a month worth at a time with a special code. We can give you a three-month prescription, but that's it, and you must have another encounter with your physician. That makes us stop and think. If we can only write 1 month, and now we have to see you back again to either test you or see if it's still appropriate, it makes us think. I-STOP was also put into, and tramadol also was rescheduled and is being watched as well. The I-STOP program is a real-time or near real-time database in New York State. Other states preceded us in having good databases. Our previous database for pharmacy prescriptions had about a six-week lag time in them. So basically the one that exists now, every single prescription as you fill it that's a controlled substance is within 24 hours entered into the database. So the pharmacists are required to enter it at the time of sale or distribution. The physicians are required at the time of your visit. Each and every time we're going to write something, we're required to look at that database, and that we're monitored, and we're fined if we don't, to see if you filled something else of similar similar nature from somebody else or something that might interact with it. Now, there are flaws to that system. It doesn't record anything that's been given to you from an emergency room that's a short 5-day supply or under 5 days. It does not record methadone that you've been administered from a clinic. And there are a couple of caveats there that it doesn't capture some things. And, of course, it doesn't capture what you borrowed from mom. So you can still be prescribing something that might interact with something they take, and they still could be an addict. So what we're also advocating, and the CDC recommends, that we drug test our patients on a regular basis. Everyone doesn't do that. I do that frequently. Within 6 weeks or so of prescribing the first controlled substance that they're going to be maintained on, and every 6 months or so after that, more frequently if I have any suspicions. And so that periodically if somebody comes in and is in need of a controlled substance, I'm going to ask them to show me that they're compliant with therapy by doing that. So I go office to office in doctor's offices and help them learn how to put this into their day without setting their day back, because it's something that's uncomfortable for some physicians to do. It does take time. We don't make money on it. And as far as we also are trying to educate our physicians. There's some recommendation that we would be required to take new courses on opiate prescribing and safe opiate prescribing, which is a plus, and that would be an every year CME requirement for everyone that writes those controlled substances in a certain amount, and it's fairly standard that most people that are writing controlled opiates would fall within that. We're going out to the offices and doing those things, and just trying to increase awareness with respect to drug companies. Most of these substances are generic. It doesn't really benefit a drug company. Nobody promotes them. There are some forms of medicines for chronic pain that are safeguarded or somehow, safety made so that they can't be dissolved and used to inject or things like that. Those may still be branded, and there are a few of those. But for the most part, we're talking about generic medications, and it's not a drug company that's making millions on them.
And if you want to know more about the iStop law, I think Laura described it very well, but our Take Care show did a great interview with one of the main sponsors, the state senator, I think it was, or assemblyman, I can't remember, who sponsored the law. And WRVO.org, that interview's still there, and it explains exactly why they decided to, put in place these measures that they did. Thank you.
I'm not in the medical profession, and I can say we're talking about a tremendous multi-billion-dollar industry is what it's become. And so when you have that piece, you always have the potential to continue profits. If you look online at a new opiate that just came out, Zohydro is its name.
It's awful.
Look at the strength of it. Look, it's not in a tamper-proof form. It is a designer drug by a legitimate pharmaceutical company to address this issue. And I'm not saying to solve it. It's a drug that's going to exacerbate it. So you do have some companies out there, I can say that, I don't have to worry about it, that are adding to the problem.
Oh, yeah. And we were surprised that they passed that drug. Tell you that we've discussed in our building not allowing any of our physicians to prescribe it at all and to get it out of our realm of things. It's just awful.
And I don't want that publicly to go on air that drug's out there, because people will now request it and seek it out. It's that powerful.
Well, I appreciate all of your questions. We're going to have to wrap up now. If anyone still has another question, perhaps our panelists might stick around for a few minutes. But thank you for participating. That concludes our forum on the rise of heroin addiction. I want to thank our panelists, Dr. Laura Martin, an addiction specialist, Brad Finn, executive from Prevention Network, and Ashley, a former heroin addict and now a substance abuse counselor. Thank you very much for joining us for this broadcast. I want to thank Mark Lavonier, our engineer and editor of this forum. Lorraine Rapp is our producer, and Leah Landry was our graphic designer. And thanks to the Central New York Community Foundation for hosting us here at the CNY Philanthropy Center. This is the latest in our series of community forums on health topics, which WRVO Public Media is holding throughout our listening region. These forums are sponsored by the Health Foundation for Western and Central New York and can also be heard on WRVO.org. I'm Catherine Loper. Thank you for joining this discussion on WRVO Public Media.